Smart Eyewear Highlight, sponsored by Innovative Eyewear, developer and provider of cutting-edge Lucid Bluetooth glasses. Lucid Smart Eyewear is multifunctional, meeting the needs of the optical, hearable, and digital assistant markets. Innovative Eyewear. NASDAQ trading symbol LUCY. Lucy. Web address lucyd.co.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Michael Auslan of the Hoover Institution, writing most recently about China, but not just China, the involvement of all the great nations in the quandary that is presented by the People's Republic of China, the aggression, the harsh words, the unhappiness, the tangle of trading relationships in the region and around the world. Michael has written about all these things, so I ask him first to help us understand how this cacophony of threats is conjoined with the ambition for everybody to maintain China as a vital geopolitical power. Michael is the author most recently of Asia's New Geopolitics, Essays on Reshaping the Indo-Pacific. That's certainly where we are. Michael, good evening to you. You begin your essay by pointing out the fact that Global Britain is deploying a warship to East Asia. I believe that Global France is also involved in the Quad, the India, Australia, Japan, and the United States in the Indo-Pacific. How do you interpret this decision by the Boris Johnson government to deploy a warship to a place far, far away? Good evening to you, Michael.
Good evening, John. Well, I think it's pretty simple. The London government has finally decided that they have to deal with the China that they have and not the China that they want. The Prime Minister just a few months ago stated that he was fervently Sinophile, meaning that he was thoroughly enamored with China. But, you know, the reality is that Britain, like all countries around the world, are having to deal with what they perceive to be threats to their own interests. And this is regardless of what's happening with the United States. And so, having concluded a major review of their security policies called the Integrated Review, Britain, for the first time since the Falklands War back in 1982, is sending not just a warship, they're sending their newest aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, but they're actually sending an entire carrier strike group, which will include a U.S. destroyer and a Netherlands ship as well. And it will also have U.S. Marine Corps F-35B fighter aircraft on board. And this is going to be a 7-month deployment or even an 8-month deployment. It will go all the way up to Japan, and then it will come back down through the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean. And it is being labeled by the British very clearly and very openly as a deployment to help uphold the international rules and norms of freedom of navigation and maritime law in the face of the challenge that China poses.
Michael, you present the mystery of this because in your essay in Foreign Policy, because we got into this over trade. That was the original discord. I believe the Trump administration is given credit or blame, depending on where you stand, for disputing China as the manufacturer of the United States and of reviving East Asia. We got into it about trade, but you've just very carefully illustrated it is now involving warships of two great seafaring nations. In fact, you point to Admiral Tony Radakin of the British Navy, the first Sea Lord, and Mike Kilday, the Chief of Naval Operations. So in the making that transition from trade, which is theoretically about container ships, to warships, what happened in between, Michael? Is there a way to understand what happened in Beijing that we went from disputing money to disputing guns?
Well, I think it's been an evolution over the past decade, and that in itself has grown out of the 4 decades of engagement between the United States and the People's Republic of China since the normalization of relations in 1979. The idea of bringing China into the global community of tapping into its economic potential is something that was the main focus of U.S. administrations through the 1970s and 80s and 1990s. And so their bet on bringing a post-Mao Zedong China into the world worked. What they didn't anticipate was just how powerful that China would become, and more importantly, how it would hold very different visions of global order and its own role in this system, and how it would seek in many ways to co-opt it or undermine it or challenge it. And so that evolution from butter to guns is in some ways an outgrowth of the fact that for decades we only looked at one real element of this relationship with China, which was the economic one, and ignored the ways in which it was growing into becoming a challenge to the international system, and that extended into questions of espionage, of intellectual property, of propaganda and intimidation campaigns, and the outright power politics of, for example, taking over territory in the South China Sea, threatening Taiwan, threatening neighbors around it.
The split between China and its neighbors, split between China and other geopolitical powers, you cite in your essay that perhaps we can date it to President Trump, the letter signed by academics, discouraged academics because of the harsh relations between China and the United States. But I can recall, Michael, and I don't remember the date, the break with Japan, and I believe there was arson at Japanese car dealerships in China, and there were parades, demonstrations, loud protests against Japan having to do with the Prime Minister of Japan visiting a shrine that in some fashion was seen to honor soldiers who committed criminal acts in China during the Second War. I can recall that split then. Was that foreshadowing? Because she wasn't in power at that point. I believe it was Hu Jintao, is my memory, maybe even before. Was that a foreshadowing of where we are now? In other words, underneath everything, has there always been this tension, and we chose not to see it?
Well, that's a great question. I think that in terms of the Japan-China case, the riots that you're referencing go back about a decade to, in fact, a territorial dispute between the two, which is still going on in the East Japan, the East China Sea, where Japan has control over a set of islands called the Senkakus. The Chinese call them the Daoyu. These were controlled by Japan before World War II, according to Japanese claims. The U.S. had some administration of them after World War II. The Japanese took them over again, and the Chinese claimed them for themselves. So it's an extremely complicated territorial dispute between the two, according to maritime law. The administration of the islands has been under the Japanese since the early 1970s, and yet as China has expanded its activities and actions throughout the near seas of East Asia, it has begun to claim these territories, just as it has done in the South China Sea, as it's done in the Paracels and the Spratly Islands. The Japanese are a much more powerful nation to deal with, and so for a decade now, these two have been jockeying over these islands, with the Chinese sending different types of fishing vessels and maritime patrol vessels and navy vessels into those waters, and the Japanese countering with the Japanese Coast Guard and sometimes even the Japanese Navy. That translated that tension into broader historical disputes between the two that had been a separate issue over the visits to the shrine. You mentioned the Yasukuni Shrine in Tokyo, where there are 18 Class A war criminals enshrined, over questions about Japanese portrayal of World War II in its history textbooks, and Chinese nationalism was deployed by Beijing in these riots to attack the Japanese embassy, to attack Japanese car dealerships and factories. But both sides also knew that they needed to pull back because of the economic integration between them. And that's exactly the nub of the problem that other nations around the world face with China, is that because of this economic integration, they are hamstrung in certain ways from dealing with the challenges to their security or in fact, economic interests such as intellectual property rights from China. So there are different ways in which these tensions are played out. You have demonstrations against different countries. You, of course, have the Wolf Warrior diplomacy. You have Chinese propaganda campaigns around the world. And the new era of China relations with the world that we are in, which, you know, some date back to 2017 or so, is precisely because the nature of this challenge has become too strong to ignore. It was ignored for decades because everybody wanted to trade with China. Everybody wanted the benefits from China. Now they're recognizing not only some of the costs of doing that, but of actual threats to their interests. In the case of Japan, the Senkakus. The U.S. plays a unique role in not having, you know, territory that's disputed with China in the region, but in having not only close relations but outright security alliances with a number of the nations, including the Philippines and Japan, that have these disputes with China. And therefore, America trying to figure out how it maintains relations with China while supporting international law and supporting its allies and partners.
What we have then is a tangle that's evolved over these last years. I would say the last 10 years are critical here. And Michael's written about how we got into this mess. Now, what is to be done? When we come back, the essay is turns on warships going to East Asia, but it also turns on all of the neighborhood aroused and sometimes confrontationally aroused, quite independent of the U.S. Michael Austin, author of Asia's New Geopolitics, Essays on Reshaping the Indo-Pacific. He's a fellow at the Stanford University's Hoover Institution. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.